Next case is 2-10-67, FLFMC versus WAML. Mr. Hertz, good morning. Welcome.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Since 1842, there's been a federal statute that has prohibited the false marking of an item with a patent with the intent to deceive the public. And that prohibition has been enforceable by a common informer through a device of a quitam action. Although the court below in this case did not reach the Article 2, Section 3, take care question, Appellee WAML is seeking affirmance of the dismissal of relator's case on the grounds that the quitam provision is unconstitutional. The United States has intervened to defend the constitutionality of 292B. The issue before this court is whether the statute permitting the filing of a Section 292B case by a private relator and allowing a common informer to prosecute the case is unconstitutional on its face.
I'm a little confused by precisely the government's position is in this case. You're urging, it seems to me, on the one hand, you're urging us to decide the constitutional question in this context because there are a lot of cases pending below, so forth. But then, at least like on page 6, and you say this elsewhere too, you suggest that there's been no problem with our intervention here, our meaning government. We didn't seek to intervene. And you say, we assume for present purposes that the absence of such authority to intervene would present additional constitutional considerations. In other words, those questions aren't presented in this case. So I'm a little, I see some tension between that position. Do you want us to decide the constitutionality even in the absence of some request by the government to intervene? And if so, do you think you therefore would preserve the right to re-argue the constitutionality question if in some context you're not granted the right to intervene?
So we obviously have intervened in the case to defend the constitutionality. When we talk about intervention, we're talking about really intervention on the merits of the false patent marking case itself.
Right.
We have not done that in this case.
Right.
Well, what difference does that make?
Well, in terms, well, we're with the,
I mean, we're asking about the structure of the statute, whether the statute is constitutional. We have to consider the statute and the way it operates, and it doesn't make any difference whether you sought to intervene in this case or not, does it?
Dyke, I have a couple of comments with respect to it. I think it does make a difference. At some point, either in this case or another case, is going to be faced with the question of whether this case should be remanded to allow the relator to proceed. WAML is taking the position that the case should be affirmed on the grounds that it's unconstitutional. We've said is the statute 292 on its face really doesn't talk about the government at all. It doesn't give the government any particular authorities with respect to the 292B case, but it doesn't prohibit the government from doing anything in particular.
Well, that's your position. I would have thought you would say that to the extent that there's a constitutional problem here, we should construe the statute to give the government some authority.
Well, we have not explicitly taken that position, in large part because there's a history of quitam statutes separate and apart from 292B, a history in this country that includes many statutes similar to 292B, which provides a prohibition and the right of a relator to go forward. And our view is that long history, some of the statutes being adopted by the very first Congress with the framers, that long history doesn't suggest that those statutes have been unconstitutional since the beginning of the Republic.
Well, I understand that, but let's suppose we reject the position that that leaving the government out of it completely would render the statute unconstitutional. I mean, shouldn't we, under those circumstances, construe the statute to provide for some government involvement that would render it constitutional?
I don't disagree with that. I think that the initial question is whether, in fact, the statute can, you know, on its face, which does not talk about intervention by the government, although this court in its rulings has provided that the government does have the right to intervene, and I think it's perfectly appropriate for the court to consider that particular provision because that is a ruling of this court. With regard to the structural challenges that you mentioned, you know, having regard to Morrison in particular, I think if Morrison is a very different case, and I think Morrison is a different case not just on the facts, but really on a very basic premise.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about the statute. Okay, first of all, what's the government's position as to whether if the government brings a criminal proceeding to collect the penalty, whether a private individual can bring a civil proceeding at the same time? Is your position that the government's bringing the proceeding would foreclose the private individual?
No.
No.
It would not.
Why not?
Because there are many instances in our jurisprudence where Congress has provided for both a criminal and civil remedy. Now, if the government brought
at the same time to collect the same penalty?
Well, it's not quite the same penalty because under additional statute, Congress has increased the, quote, criminal penalty for individuals who are convicted of infractions. So, in fact, it bumps up the penalty in the criminal side.
But if the government brings a criminal proceeding saying there were these violations and we're seeking to collect the penalty, you're saying that at the same time a private individual can sue?
It's certainly true if the government brought a criminal proceeding and failed, the relator probably would not.
But what about at the same time?
I would refer to this court's to the Supreme Court's decision in Marcus v. Hess, where the government did in fact bring a criminal proceeding, and the government actually argued, not on constitutional grounds, this was under the False Claims Act, that the relator should not be able to go forward. And the Supreme Court said no, the relator could go forward, notwithstanding the fact that the government knew about the information.
But the proceeding was over with, right?
Yes, it was proceeding. Suppose
it's not over with.
So I'm not suggesting that the government might not come into the civil proceeding and attempt to exercise what it often does in civil proceedings when they're ongoing criminal proceeding to say, ask the court, this should be stayed so it doesn't interfere with the criminal prosecution. But as an absolute matter, whether the relator can actually bring the case either at the same time or certainly after the criminal case is over, our position would be that, in fact, the relator could do that. So getting back to Morrison...
Even if that would render the statute unconstitutional?
Unconstitutional on the grounds of what, double jeopardy?
No, on the ground that the government doesn't have control that's required by the Take Care Clause.
It doesn't have control over the relator's proceeding?
Well, it doesn't have control to make the initial decision to proceed and thereby preclude a private individual from suing. I mean, it strikes me that what you're doing is you want to win such a resounding victory here that you're not open to a construction of the statute that might give the government greater control and to save it by doing it.
No, I'm not opposed to that. I think in the first instance, we are defending it on the ground that on its face, what just provides the relator for proceeding and says nothing about the government control, that the statute can be sustained on that basis. And if you're getting to Morrison and some of the cases, the separation of powers cases that suggest the analysis that you're talking about, looking at the government's control, I would suggest that this is a very different case. That the fundamental distinction is all those cases, Morrison, Mistretta, Public Accounting Oversight Board, really work a relatively novel restructuring of the government. There's no question that the independent counsel in Morrison was, quote, part of the government. That's not true of Qui Tam. The relator is considered a private individual, not part of the government. We suggest...
But what you seem to be suggesting is that in the Qui Tam, and I understand there's a difference between the two, but what you seem to be suggesting in the Qui Tam context is that you can have a situation in which the government has absolutely no say over the thing, no right to intervene, no right to bring the first proceeding, and that it's perfectly okay. Then there doesn't have to be any government control or involvement at all,
right?
Potentially or actually.
And the history would support that. The history, you know,
suppose we conclude it doesn't.
Well, that the history doesn't support it, or the history is insufficient.
Suppose we conclude that that argument and the history is insufficient, the existence of these few statutes, which didn't seem to involve any government control, passed by the first Congress, isn't sufficient to resolve the constitutional question.
So, then obviously we would urge the court to save the constitutionality and look at the controls that the government does have. As we have pointed out in our brief, with regard to the right to intervene, the right to object to a settlement once the government has intervened between...
What about construing Section 290 to provide some meaningful notice about what the proceeding is about, so that the government, in the form of the PTO, which is part of the executive branch, gets notice that this is a False Claims Act statute? Should we construe 290 to require that?
If that was necessary to save the statute, that would certainly be a possibility. I guess I would point out to the court that there have been efforts made, not necessarily record in this particular case, but working between the administrative office of the U.S. courts and the PTO to provide a better form of notice. But it seems to me that doesn't necessarily deal with the basic constitutional question. That really does suggest the amount of resources the executive branch is willing to devote to trying to identify these cases early on.
On your view of the constitutionality, you mentioned before, I think you said that our cases have construed the government as having a right to intervene.
Correct.
Let's assume that's not the case, that we were to construe the statute as not providing the government a right. You know, there's Rule 25, so you have the opportunity to try to intervene.
Correct.
But not necessarily a right. Nonetheless, would you say that the statute remains constitutional?
Again, what we would say is that the court really doesn't need to reach that question until the government has attempted to get into a case, assert a right, and has been rejected.
I'm not sure I understand how we could do that. That we would leave the door open here and say, well, we don't have to decide the intervention question because there was no request or denial here. So we're going to say it's tentatively constitutional, but leave the door open in case subsequently the government tries to get in and they can't. I don't understand
how
we expect.
What the court would be holding as constitutional here is that the relator had the right to proceed under this statute, and the case should not be dismissed because 292B on its face is unconstitutional.
But not to resolve the question about whether or not it requires intervention or in the absence of that it would still be constitutional. You're saying we should just hold that up. It's constitutional based on these facts, but if the government is not entitled to intervene, we'll revisit it at that time.
Well, I mean, we know we have the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. It does provide a mechanism for the government to ask the court to be permitted to intervene. I don't think the Take Care Clause has ever been interpreted to mean that the government always has to particularly get its way when it asks the court for a particular result. I mean, there are lots of laws that Congress has given, that Congress has passed.
That's hardly the question here.
I'm sorry?
That's not the question. The question is whether the statute should be construed to provide some sort of ability of the government to participate and to control the action. And we have to look at that, even though this isn't a case in which the government sought to intervene. We have to look at the statute to see whether it's constitutional or unconstitutional. And that depends, perhaps, on the degree of government control.
I guess I would point this court to the Fifth Circuit's decision in Riley. The en banc court essentially considered that very question about whether it needed to do sort of the Morrison analysis about government controls, or whether, in fact, based on the Stevens case, the Vermont Agency Stevens case, that it could essentially justify the constitutionality of the statute, one, based on the history, and two, based on the fact that the relator is not part of the government. And we would think that is initially the correct analysis for this court. Now, if the court disagrees...
It seems to me to be very, very hard to analyze this case and to analyze the extent to which Morrison is relevant to this case without considering the need for the government to have the opportunity to intervene or participate or exercise some control. It's parsing this issue out. The very point that Judge Prost is making seems to me to be very, very difficult for us.
So, again, our initial argument is that the court doesn't need to do that. We have argued that, in fact, If there's a need to look at controls, that in fact there are sufficient controls.
What are the controls?
The controls are, the federal rules do provide the United States to ask court to intervene, that if the government does intervene, it has certain authorities in connection with that intervention. It can object to a settlement between the relator and the defendant.
But it can't stop a settlement.
Well,
let's assume they settle, and the government's entitled to half the amount, but they settle for some amount that's far beneath what the government thinks it should be entitled to.
So
does it have any relief there, any control over it?
Well, again, I guess, again, if the government is in the case, it obviously presents its position to the court. We do think, for example, that under the quitam model that exists, that there is some authority for the government, quote, to settle its share of a quitam action, even over the relator's action, that derives from some of the nature of quitam. If you look at some of the old cases and treatises, that provides a degree of control, and that if there really is some kind of collusion between the defendant and the relator, that Rule 60B could provide a form of relief to actually set aside something that, you know, a court having to agree with the government is unfair, or inequitable, or the other terms of 60B. I think what I'm saying to the court is, just because the government has to ask the court for certain relief doesn't in itself violate the Take Care Clause.
How's the government supposed to find out about the case if the notice under 290 doesn't require the Patent Office to be told that it's a false marking case?
Well, it does require it to tell the Patent Office that it's a patent case, and then, you know, under the current situation, the way the law is, the government would presumably have to devote enough resources to essentially figure out that it's a false marking case. I think you also have to look at a little history here.
Why wouldn't you construe 290 to require some sort of meaningful notice as to what kind of case it is?
We're not objecting to that construction. If the court feels that that is what's necessary to save the constitutionality, the government wouldn't disagree with it. I can see that I'm in my rebuttal time.
No, would you like to save your rebuttal time? We'll restore your 4 minutes.
Okay. Unless the court has any initial further questions, I'll save the remainder for rebuttal.
All right. Let's hear from Mr. Oberdick.
May it please the court, Dave.
You have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll keep it brief. On behalf of FLFMC, my client, just so we're clear, we do want this court to preserve the constitutionality of the statute. We've talked of history. Let me share a little bit of personal history, individual history, if you will, as noted on page 7 of our brief. To the extent that my client has been involved in these actions and has settled 3, we have provided notice to Mr. Morris's office. We have actually engaged in that process to include them in the process.
So are you suggesting that we should construe, what matters is how we construe the statute, right? Are you suggesting that based on that history, we construe the statute as obligating you to have provided that notice?
Your Honors, if you would feel comfortable and preserve the constitutionality on that basis, yes, we would agree. That's what my client has been doing. As a practical matter, I believe a number of the relators in these actions are doing that, as indicated in the publications and what DOJ has indicated by way of their involvement in the process. But at the bottom, Your Honors, we do want it preserved. And we have been willingly participating in a notice to allow for settlements to be reviewed and approved by their office. Briefly, in connection with a separate issue, maybe not as important, but on 9B, there's a request that you also sustain on 9B grounds. As I look at BP products, Your Honor, I see that intent can be inferred if there is knowledge plus continued misrepresentation. I read WAMO's brief to indicate that they had knowledge because of the long duration of expiration of the patents here, over 25 years. They seem to indicate that anyone would know, but at least they would know. And there are 2 other factors beyond that. I think we've got knowledge, therefore, misrepresentation and the inference of intent. But we have a public record showing WEMA's involvement in a number of IP litigation matters, infringement cases. And then finally, we have corporate transactions where due diligence would have given rise to the same level of intent. I see that my time is up, brief as it was. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. All right, let's hear from the other side. Let's see. Mr. Dewey, you're going to argue first.
Yes, Judge Lennon, may it please the court. With the court's permission, Mr. Baker will address the court's questions regarding the government's right or lack of right to intervene, as well as the appointments clause issue. Turning, Judge Dyke, to your concern about construction of statutes, we have a situation here that I believe is unusual in that if we look at Section 290 and any of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, those are not being challenged here. So we can't look to preserving 290 to 290 to preserve the constitutionality of 292B. And really, I don't even know how we could do that with 290 in the notice provision there, because Section 290 has notice of all patent cases going to the commissioner, and it also has a one-month time period. I've cited examples in the brief of cases that were raised and settled well within that one-month period. So unless we construe a month
to...
But
that sort of suggests that the statute has to be perfect. Maybe it doesn't have to be perfect. Maybe 30 days is good enough.
In the cases I mentioned between the Eastern District of Texas and the Northern District of California, those were examples of cases settled within that period. So the government, not only did the government not have any ability to intervene or object to settlements, it was all, again, raised and settled within that time period.
Well, perhaps. But so coming back to your other point, what case tells us that we can't consider the constitutional question with respect to this statute in the overall environment in which it operates, including 290 and the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure? What case says that those guarantees of intervention, for example, have to be written into the false marking statute itself?
I don't necessarily think it has to be in the statute itself. It's just that the longstanding doctrine of construing a statute to preserve its constitutionality, which was at issue in a lot of the False Claims Act cases, that doesn't apply here, because we can't look to 290 or Rules of Civil Procedure to we can look to them as being relevant to how 292B operates. But we don't apply, I don't believe there's any authority for using that doctrine of construing to preserve constitutionality when what you're construing is something else.
So are you agreeing that if we, let's say hypothetically, that we said government right to intervene is essential to the constitutionality of that statute, if we find that right to intervene in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, that's okay. It doesn't have to be in the false marking statute itself.
I think I would agree with that, with the provision that we don't bend over backwards with these other rules and statutes of general application. I mean, it could be that there's some set of statutes that provide for all sorts of control mechanisms for all QTAM statutes. And I think I would agree that we could look to that other statutory scheme to provide the kind of controls necessary to preserve constitutionality here. But the problem we have here is none of the rules that are mentioned here provide anything like that level of control. As the court knows, all of the regional circuits and district courts in other circuits that address the Take Care Clause challenges had to really bend over backwards to preserve the constitutionality of the False Claims Act. They had to make sure that the government had a right to dismiss a false claims case. They had, you can see in the briefs, all sorts of other concerns about the constitutionality of the FCA. Here, we just don't have anything like that. Even if the government could intervene, what can it really do? It can't assert any kind of control over the relator, like the government can in a False Claims Act case. It can't dismiss over the relator's objection. That has to go to the court for that.
No, but it could suggest to the court that the case is lacking in merit and should be dismissed, right?
But it would have no more power over the court than any amici that might show up to make that same point. I don't see how we could construe a Rule 24 and say, well, we're going to construe that Rule 24 to provide the government with something beyond what that rule provides. That's just a rule of general application. So, intervention is just the beginning of the problem here. We have the notice problem. We have the fact that the government has no control over the initiation of these cases, no ability to dismiss, of the objection.
Well, why couldn't we construe the statute to say if the government proceeds criminally to collect the penalty that the private action has to be stayed?
I don't know that there would be any way for the court to construe that, because 292B is so open-ended and permissive. It just says any person may sue for the penalty, and so there's nothing in A or B that would seem to give the court anything to latch a hold of and say that there's any inherent right of the government to stop any private action from proceeding at the same time.
Well, I mean, it doesn't seem to me to be unusual to say that you try to reconcile the two sections of the statute and that the purpose of the statute requires avoiding of duplicative proceedings if the government has decided to proceed first on its own.
I just don't see what language within Section A would provide that, though. I understand the basic idea.
I guess construing statutes to avoid constitutional problems doesn't depend on finding explicit language. In fact, that's the whole point of the doctrine, is that you construe the statute to avoid the problem without explicit language. If there were explicit language, you wouldn't need to resort to the constitutional canon of construction.
Well, yeah, I understand that with explicit language, but usually there's something in a statute you can latch a hold of and say, well, we see in here some kind of implicit right, but I just don't, just thinking offhand of the language of Section A, subsection A, I can't think of what that would be. But again, even if the government can intervene, and Mr. Baker will certainly address that point, you still have enormous control problems here. I believe, just as a practical matter, I'm only aware of one case, the Stauffer case, where the government has intervened, and we have something close to 1,000 cases that have been filed under the statute. As a practical matter, the intervention is just not an issue in these cases. This all goes on without the awareness of the government, and important to keep in mind with the False Claims Act, the government actually has rights even where it does not intervene. There is certainly nothing in 292B or A that gives the government any power whatsoever when it does not intervene.
Well, of course, that was true of Morrison and Olson also, right? Once the government asked for the appointment of the independent counsel, the government had no role to play in the case.
But that's a very big once, though, a very big condition precedent. The government there, nothing ever happened. No independent counsel was ever appointed unless the government decided, the Attorney General decided, that certain conditions were met. The Attorney General had unreviewable discretion not to appoint an independent counsel.
Well, I understand that, but it does suggest that control of the ongoing litigation by the government is not a constitutional necessity, even in a context like Morrison.
No, but I think when you put it all together in Morrison, you had the unreviewable discretion of the AG not to appoint. You had the independent counsel bound by DOJ guidelines. The independent counsel's scope of authority was determined by the AG's factual findings. And the independent counsel was subject to removal. Just nothing like that is present here with the False Markings Act, False Markings Statute. And the government seems to want to ignore Morrison and latch a hold of the one circuit court that suggested Morrison was inapplicable. But really, if you look at it, the four regional circuits, the 2nd, 6th, 9th, five district courts and other circuits all applied Morrison to the question of whether the False Claims Act was going to withstand constitutional scrutiny.
Is the key here, in your view, the government's ability to zap the case at the outset?
I think it has to have control over all aspects. First off, it has to have notice. It has to have, how can it have any control if it doesn't even know about the case? And so notice is a fundamental problem here that was not present in Morrison or any of the False Claims Act cases. These cases appear and disappear before the government is even aware of them. And then, of course, it's common that somebody will file a claim based on one patent, and then the settlement agreement will end up being broader than the original case. So there's really no notice mechanism here. So that's a non-starter right there, that the government can't even find out about these cases often. But I don't think it's simply a matter of government being able to dismiss. I think it's also the government has to have some level of control, maybe not complete control, but some level of control over the initiation of the suit, the prosecution of the suit, and the termination of the suit. But of course, it's got to have notice. And I don't see any way that you could possibly construe 290 to provide that kind of notice, because there's nothing there about false marking in 290, and there's a very important 1-month delay there. And it just, again, as a practical matter, as I've cited in the brief, In so many of these cases, no notice was ever given. No notice was given in this case. This is no hypothetical question. In this case, no 290 notice was filed. And I had other examples of that in the brief as well, including the Pequeno case. I don't think there's any way to preserve this statute by looking at 290 or any of these rules of civil procedure of common application. So if there's no further questions, I'll turn it over to Mr. Baker. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dewey. Mr. Baker? You had 7 minutes, but your counsel yielded some time, so we'll push that up to 9.
Thank you very much.
Doesn't mean you necessarily need to use all that time, but you have it.
I understand, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Miller Baker on behalf of the Chamber of Commerce of the United States of America. The linchpin of the government's argument under the Take Care Clause is that the government has a right to intervene in these cases. That is simply incorrect as a matter of law.
That seems to be kind of a difficult argument, since the government does have an interest in the outcome because they share in the recovery. So why wouldn't they have a right to intervene?
The question, Your Honor, is whether it's a cognizable interest under the statute. And the statute says that only a person can bring an action under Section 292B. The Supreme Court in the Vermont Agency case said that that there's a presumption of statutory construction that a person is not a sovereign. So the United States is a sovereign, is not a person, and therefore cannot intervene. That was recognized.
Wouldn't it be a general principle that if somebody has an interest in the recovery, that they could intervene under the statute? What case suggests that someone with a monetary interest like that can't intervene?
Your Honor, the case is the case of United States versus Bond that was decided 150 years ago in a district court in Ohio, in which the United States attempted to bring an action under the predecessor statute to Section 292B. The district court in that case said
I'm not asking about that. What I'm saying, let's assume you're right, that the government, if it wants to proceed, has to proceed criminally, and it can't proceed civilly under subsection B. But it still has an interest in the recovery. What case says that under the federal rules of civil procedure you don't have a right to intervene where you have a right to share in the recovery?
The cases under the federal rules are that you have to be able to assert a complaint. The government can't file a complaint under Section 290B to recover its half of the award. The government's claim here is only to the half of the award.
So if we reject that position, then you agree they could intervene?
Yes, Your Honor, but that's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. But the government here has an interest in a recovery that only the relator may seek. Only the relator can bring a complaint under Section 292B, and if the relator recovers half of that claim, receives an award, then half of that is owed to the government, and the government can then recover that. But the government cannot assert a complaint in the Section 292B action because it's not a person. And the Supreme Court in Vermont Agency reiterated the rule of construction that in a statute, a reference to a person does not include the sovereign. Because the United States is not a person, it cannot bring its own action under Section 292B. That principle has been recognized for 150 years. The government likes to rely upon history, but that's one element of history that the government seeks to overlook here. I'd now like to turn to the Appointments Clause of Article 2. The key language from the dispositive decision here is Buckley versus Vallejo from 1976. And the critical language from Buckley is found at page 140 of the decision, 424 U.S. and 140. It says, we hold that these provisions of the Act vesting in the Commission primary responsibility for conducting civil litigation in the courts of the United States for vindicating public rights violate Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2. Such functions may be discharged only by persons who are officers of the United States within the language of that section. The crux of this is the function performed by the litigant. And the function here is the enforcement of the public laws of the United States. Under the government's logic, the Federal Election Commission that was struck down in Buckley would have been perfectly valid if instead of that function having been assigned to the commission, if that function had been outsourced to private relators.
So under your theory, then all QI-TAM statutes are unconstitutional under the Appointments Clause.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And this is the reason why, if you rule for WAMO here on the basis of the Appointments Clause, you're not going to take down the False Claims Act. And that is the distinction, the critical distinction between private and public rights. In the False Claims Act, what is being asserted there are private rights. It's the proprietary injury of the United States. That is a private right. It's essentially a tort claim by the government that the government has assigned to the relator. That was recognized in the Vermont Agency case. That's the basis for standing under the False Claims Act. This is fundamentally different. Here we have public rights. This is the enforcement of public law with penal provisions. So therefore, if the Appointments Clause is the basis for invalidating this particular QI-TAM statute, it will not take down the False Claims Act, because the False Claims Act represents the assertion of the government's private or proprietary interests. The government relies on two cases, Haddon and Germain, for the proposition that because a relator is not an officer, it does not hold a position within the government, that the Appointments Clause doesn't apply. These cases simply hold that these individuals were not officers of the United States because they were agents of the United States. In the Offman case, an appraiser of merchandise was held to be an agent and therefore did not need to be appointed in conformance with the Appointments Clause. Likewise, in Germain, we had a case in which the surgeon was appointed to examine pension applicants, and he was charged with extortion. The statute simply didn't apply to this gentleman because he was not an officer of the United States. Instead, was merely an agent of the United States government in conducting his duties. In this case, we know that the relator is not an agent of the United States. That's the holding of Vermont Agency, in which the court said that a QI-TAM relator is not an agent of the government because they possess an interest by statute in the outcome of the litigation. So in this case, we have relators, private relators, who are exercising the function of vindicating the public rights of the United States. And under Article 2 and the Appointments Clause, that function under Buckley can only be exercised by an officer of the United States. Unless there are any other questions, I will yield the time.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Hertz, you get the final word.
Let me touch on a number of points, starting, and again, one of the key distinctions I think that the court has to keep in mind between a number of the cases, including Buckley versus Vallejo, including Morrison, is the distinction between somebody who is acting as the government, which is the case of the independent counsel in Morrison, as is the case of the Federal Election Commission in Buckley versus Vallejo, versus a private individual. The touchstone of separation of powers is whether one branch is aggrandizing itself vis-a-vis another branch, or it's impermissibly interfering with another branch's right to perform its constitutional duties. And it seems to me we know a couple of things from history. The Supreme Court has said many times Congress can choose how it wants to enforce particular laws. One of the things that Congress has done is there are lots of examples where it has given to private individuals the right to enforce, quote, public laws. So, for example, a private individual can bring a Sherman antitrust case, or they can bring a civil RICO case, or they can bring a Title VII case for punitive damages. All those things are essentially enforcing public rights we give to to private individuals. The remarkable thing is none of those cases seem to have ever been challenged on the grounds that they violate the Take Care Clause. Now, it is true in those cases those individual plaintiffs have, quote, standing. They have to show the constitutional minimum of an injury in fact. But the standing is really taken care of in the QI-TAM situation, which is another example of Congress assigning to private persons the right to enforce public rights. Standing is taken care of by, as Stevens tells us, history, one, and two, the assignment provision. And there's no reason to think that in those cases that I mentioned, the Title VII cases, the civil RICO, that there's not as potential as mischief in those cases to upset the executive branch's view of what the law should be or what it might want to do in a RICO case or what it might want to do in the antitrust situation as there is in the QI-TAM situation. With regard to Vermont Agency, let me just point out that the court held that as a defendant person couldn't include a state with regard to a quitam private individual relator. I note there's a concurrence in Vermont agency that talks about leaving the question open, whether one that would be the result if the United States was to sue a private person. And here, what we're talking about a person is we're talking about who would be the plaintiff. So, for example, there are False Claims Act cases where states have been, quote, persons for purposes of affirmatively filing a case. And our position would be, notwithstanding the very old district court case, which I don't think represents a continuation of history, it's one case in the mid-1800s, our position would be that the United States could be a person under 292B, could file a quitam suit, could, in fact, if a defendant came to the government before it was sued, settle with them, a complete settlement that would be effective. With regard to the Court of Appeals cases dealing with the False Claims Act, per se, I would note the majority of those cases were decided before the Supreme Court's case in Stevens. It's only the Riley case that really comes after Stevens, and I think Stevens suggests that the analysis with regard to quitam is somewhat different than what we look to the structural cases that you were talking about before, because quitam is fundamentally different. With regard to staying a case, if it was a criminal case, I think courts have inherent power to stay a case, and certainly at the request of the United States, there's a whole body of case law where the United States has come in and asked to stay a civil case where it's going to interfere with a criminal case. I guess the last point I'd make about Morrison, again, is really Morrison went to a core executive power, the Ethics in Government Act, talked about issuing subpoenas, trying members of the executive branch. Once the independent counsel was appointed, the executive branch could no longer investigate. Interestingly enough, the one thing accepted from the Ethics in Government Act would be violations of something that's called an infraction, which is what 292A is. And so it looks and feels like a completely different case in terms of interfering with a core executive power which was involved in Morrison, which was sustained, versus dealing with a single statute involving patent mismarking, where in fact the government, for better or for worse, doesn't have a history of filing a lot of these cases. As this court said, Congress could choose to let the private interests do that. The court has no further questions. We'd ask that the constitutionality be sustained.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hertz.
Thank
you. Mr. Oberdick, Mr. Dewey, Mr. Baker. Thank you very much. Case is submitted.